This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana on Labor Day. We'll visit with Jason Berry, the New Orleans-based investigative reporter. He broke the story of widespread sexual abuse by priests in the Catholic Church in his 1992 book, Lead Us Not Into Temptation. Jason Berry will comment on the reaction of Pope Francis to recent revelations of abuse, and he offers some suggestions for the pontiff. Also, author Christina Dalcher on her book, Vox, a much-talked-about novel that involves many themes, including feminism. Kel Waltman will be here to tell the story of Sadie Thibodeau, a woman who went missing and was found by the Cajun Navy in New Orleans. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on Labor Day, a live show. And if you'd like to join the conversation, your universal number is 877-217-5757. You can always send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Jason Berry, an investigative reporter, New Orleans-based, author and film director, and he is known for his pioneering reporting on sexual abuse in the priesthood of the Catholic Church. In 1992, he broke new ground with Lead Us Not Into Temptation, Catholic Priest and the Sexual Abuse of Children. That was followed up by many other works from Jason Berry, including a 2011 book, Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. And this has been a difficult time for Roman Catholics, both in the United States and abroad, with new revelations. And Jason Berry, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Pleasure to be with you as always.
Well, it's always good to talk with you, and I don't exaggerate when I say you are the reporter who is most responsible for getting the ball rolling on reporting these sexual misdeeds by priests primarily in the Catholic Church. And before we get to that and what's happened contemporaneously, you are a Roman Catholic, aren't you?
I am, yes.
Has your faith been shaken at all?
Oh, absolutely. It it has been a long spiritual struggle over these many years. And I do go to Mass, and I search for good liturgies. And I guess the most honest thing I can say is that the more I learn, the more I question, but I have found it hard to leave as well.
In a piece in the Washington Post, you write that Pope Francis is facing a crisis of justice. What should he do in this crisis, in your judgment?
Sure. I think he needs to do three things. First, at some point, he does have to come out and address and say something about the letter that Archbishop Vigano has put out, which has made a great deal of news, you know, accusing the Pope of basically being part of this cover-up pattern with regard to McCarrick, the cardinal who has, you know, since resigned as a cardinal. But that is, I think, a smaller point compared to what he can and, in my view, should do with the enormous powers of his office. The Pope is literally a one-man Supreme Court in the code of canon law. And I think he should use those powers sweepingly on several fronts. First, it's little known that Pope John Paul II offered Mother Teresa a seat in the conclave that would elect his successor. In other words, he was willing to make her a cardinal. And there is no restriction on the Pope as to the people he can put into the College of Cardinals. It is historically the enclave of princes of the Church who rise from priest to bishop to cardinal. I think he should expand it radically. I think he should include women. There are any number of highly capable religious sisters. Certainly, you know, Christine Schenck, the founder of Future Church, would be one that I would recommend. They've done pioneering work with the Liturgy of Lamentation for abuse survivors. Jennifer Hasselberger is a canon lawyer in Minnesota who blew the whistle on the corrupt bishop there. I would argue that she is just as capable of being a cardinal as any number of the men who are in it right now. I could go on. I could give you a long list. But I think that would be an important thing to do. And I think it would also serve as a way for him to hold an international conference and draw together many of the people who have been critics of the church. Tom Doyle, the canon lawyer, is one. Patrick Wall, another. You know, to get out of this crisis, we need a deep structural change. I think changing the celibacy law would make a huge difference. And it's important to understand that celibacy does not cause men to abuse children any more than marriage can be blamed on incest when, you know, a father does something terrible to a child. That said, celibacy is the cornerstone of church governing. It is a requirement. It's a law. And I think changing it would rejuvenate the priesthood by bringing in men whose focus is not on gaining power within the church, but on being ministers and having families. So I would say those are the third thing, too, Jim, I should add, is Francis needs an independent judiciary in the Vatican, not connected to canon law. This could be done by constitutional scholars. Give them 3 months in Rome or even 6 months and let them hammer out a way that an independent criminal court could function to oversee all the bishops and religious order superiors. And by doing that, it would free the Pope from the position he's in now of having to be an emergency chief of police dealing with these scandals that are breaking across the globe. So I think in a structural sense, that would be a very important thing to do.
In mid-August, the New York Times and other newspapers, but the newspaper of record in our country, had above the fold the story that was the big story of the week and maybe of the year, a catalog of horrors in Pennsylvania, more than 300 priests in 70 years. Pennsylvania is a bigger state than Louisiana, but you have seen it here in Louisiana, this abuse by some priests, a minority, but still significant enough that it has to shake the faith of the flock. And maybe there is a demand now to do something more so than ever before, but will this wane or will it pick up momentum?
Well, that's a hard one to answer, Jim. This scandal has moved in waves over the last 30 years. What I thought was the great tsunami happened after the Boston Globe coverage began in 2002. Some people may not remember, there was a tremendous media coverage in the early 1990s. You might call it the first big wave of these cases, this coverage. The media narrative itself, indeed, has waxed and waned. But I think what we're in right now, whether this becomes a day-in, day-out, front-page headline, it is not as important as what these findings are about. They're getting deeper and deeper into the culture of bishops and cardinals and the dynamics of the cover-up. So, I don't want to sound like Jeremiah polishing his horn, but I do think this is going to continue, and I think it is the challenge of Francis's papacy to see whether he can do something. And you know, the other issue here is that there is a very hardened movement in some conservative circles of the church, wealthy circles, I might add, people who want to blame the whole thing on the phenomenon of gay priests and homosexuality in general, which I think is really a straw horse or a scapegoat, if you will. There are indeed gay networks within clerical life and the hierarchy. But the real problem is a culture of corrosive secrecy that has turned a blind eye to this criminal sexual underground, in which a great many girls have been abused, not just teenage boys. So it is a complex phenomenon. And sadly, I would say it has not seen its crest because we have not seen an adequate response.
I know where you went to school, Jason. You probably had an upbringing much like mine. I had 13 years of Catholic education. I never encountered any bad things from a priest or a nun, other than being hit on the butt with a ruler. But this apparently is far more widespread than we thought.
Yes, that's true. And like you, I am a product of Catholic education. I went to Jesuit High School in New Orleans and graduated from Georgetown. And like you, I never experienced any untoward advances by a priest or a nun. But, you know, what we're seeing is a jagged revelation of what the internal culture of the church is like. And I go back to what I said a few moments ago. This is a story that has been gradually opening out into a much longer and deeper narrative for a generation now. Even though many of us who had wonderful experiences growing up, and I think it's one of the reasons I've been, you know, holding on to what I believe, can look at this and, you know, unless you're like me, kind of shake your head and say, gee, I never saw any of it. It really, I think, has reached a point where the priests who don't talk about this from, you know, in sermons are doing a disservice to the laity. Archbishop Amon just the other night in New Orleans issued quite an apology and had a special mass last Tuesday night.
All right, we do have to take a short pause, but we will return for another segment with Jason Berry after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and happy Labor Day. Your number is 877-217-5757. You can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We have a few of those for Jason Berry, our guest, who is the reporter who was a pioneer in reporting sexual abuse in his church, a church that, of course, is quite prominent in Louisiana, the Roman Catholic Church. 877-217-5757. There have been recent revelations, both in the United States and abroad, about sexual abuse from priests. And Jason, you many moons ago unearthed the story about Gilbert Gothe, and he was a monster, wasn't he?
He was indeed. Yeah, he represented well over, he abused and molested well over 100 children in the Acadiana parishes near Lafayette. He was in Henry and other towns in Vermilion Parish. He did 10 years in prison. Then he was released early. He was accused of abuse again. The first third of the book I did in 92, Lead Us Not Into Temptation, is about the impact on that deeply Catholic community. And then the book moves on to address national issues. But yes, that's how I got started.
E.J. Dionne, in his most recent column, says, I could detail the reasons for my personal gratitude to the church, the list of the devoted people I know, nuns and lay women who carry out missions of mercy and argue that its core teachings about our obligations to each other remain urgent in our wounded world. But like many at this moment, I am struggling, wondering if the church can meet its own obligations to those it injured wantonly, above all, and to the faithful who are still in search of a compelling answer when they're asked, how can you stay? And you, Jason, are one of those. You say you stay because something is definitely there that you do not want to retreat from.
Well, that's correct. There are a lot of reasons for that, which, frankly, I'm addressing in the next book I'm doing. But I can say this. I think for people who are Catholic and recognize that there is solace and fellowship in the Mass, and people for whom the liturgy, particularly communion, is a central part of their lives, it's hard to walk away. But the tearing question, and I think E.J. Dionne's piece hits on that quite eloquently, is how do you balance your own inner life and spirituality with the specter of so much rot and institutional corruption? I mean, the problem is the power structure from the Vatican on down. And while there are many bishops who labor to do the right things, we've got a Catholic school system. Catholic Charities USA is one of the frontline providers of social services in this country, all to the good. We are at a crossroads, at a crisis, and I don't know how the Pope will respond, but I hope he takes principal steps and gets ahead of this so that we can begin to heal those deeper wounds.
Dale and Walden asks your perception of the Pope. What do you think of Pope Francis?
Oh, I think he's the most fascinating figure on the global stage. And what is most intriguing to me about him is his capacity to change. The fact that he said, "Who am I to judge?" when asked a question about a gay priest several years ago, indicates a broader idea of conscience and forgiveness. You know, if I can just make a quick remark here, the Church's teaching on homosexuality is antiquated. It is over 1,000 years old. It is rooted in Scripture. It does not take into account the findings of science. We know that gay people are unable to change their orientation. They don't choose to be that way. And so the fundamental question becomes free will. If you cannot change your orientation, what then? What right does the Church have to tell gay people that wanting lives of sexual intimacy is wrong? Going back to the Pope, I mean, the fact that he has put poor people and migrants at the center of his agenda calls us to the best impulses of Catholicism, I believe. And he is facing an enormous crisis. He has intervened and removed certain bishops. He changed his position on the crisis in Chile after ordering a massive internal report by Monsignor Scicluna, who is the chief investigator and whom I know, on one of my trips to Rome. I got to talk with him at some length. So Francis is changing. And I think a leader, especially the leader of a global faith, who has the capacity to change, gives us hope, and also, in a strictly journalistic sense, is a fascinating story.
Ray in Prairieville. Ray, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Jason Barry. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking the call. Just one question. It sounds like I'm glad to hear Mr. Barry on today. And somebody who has really studied this, what the question I'd have is, does Pope Francis have the power to remove celibacy as a requirement for the priesthood and for the nuns, for that matter?
What about the Pope unilaterally saying that this is over? Can he do that?
It's a very good question, sir. Yes, he does. Celibacy is a law, and it can be changed with the stroke of a papal pen. Popes in the past have not seen fit to do that. I don't think they felt it was necessary. But we've seen a tremendous drop-off in the number of priests in the last 40 or 50 years. In fact, one of the reasons that in so many American cities they're having to close churches and sell them as real estate is because they do not have enough priests to staff each church. In some cities, paying for the abuse settlements is another factor. But demographically, the church has lost 100,000 men left the priesthood between 1968, the year after the celibacy encyclical, which praised it by Pope Paul VI, and the year 2004. I haven't kept up with the data in the last 14 years, but I'm sure it's not much different. So, yes, the Pope has that singular power. He can do that.
Recently, you wrote a column about Andrew Greeley, and years ago, we're talking, I guess, four decades ago, he was speaking out on these things, and it wasn't received well by the church, and many called him crazy. Turns out he was quite prophetic in many ways.
Yeah, it was not that far back. I think his first column was maybe 86, and he did a lot more in the early 90s. I knew Father Greeley well, and we became friends. He wrote the introduction to my 1992 book, and he was outraged. You know, he was a prolific novelist. He, as a sociologist, he was arguably the leading social scientist on the Catholic Church of his generation. And he was furious about what was happening, and the bishops feared his pen, but none of them was willing to take any action against him. He had a sort of unique perch of independence, and yes, he was prophetic on it.
Where do you see this going? It's uncertain, but you seem, based on your remarks, Jason, to believe there is momentum headed in the direction of change.
Well, I do for this reason, Jim. We have never seen a pope under attack the way Francis is today. I mean, the archbishop who is now in hiding, I mean, you couldn't make up a novel like this and have people believe it, but you've got a former Vatican ambassador to the United States, Archbishop Vigano, who is now in hiding but talking to a few reporters, the New York Times being one of them. And his story, which has taken a lot of hits, a lot of the credibility of what he's said has been contradicted by reporting in recent days.
We do have to roll, but Jason Berry, I hope we can call on you again soon. Thank you for joining us. A most sensitive topic handled in Jason's delicate and insightful way. We're back after the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're visiting with Christina Dalcher. She is the author of one of the most talked-about novels in America right now, Vox, set in the United States, in which half the population has been silenced. Vox is the harrowing, unforgettable story of what one woman will do to protect herself and her daughter. And it is a story that I think many will view as a feminist story, but what do you think is the primary statement that Vox makes, Christina?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show, Jim. I really appreciate this. And as far as the message, I think we can certainly look at it as a feminist story, but we can also look at it, and this is very important to me, as a sort of a, I don't want to say call to arms, because that sounds too violent, but a call to pay attention and a call to action. You know, in my mind, it's really a story for everyone, because at its heart, Vox, and it is about a woman, Jean McClellan, who really didn't pay attention, who didn't vote, who didn't get involved, and never thought that the world would change overnight.
Jean McClellan is paired with her friend Jackie, and they are two characters in direct opposition.
That's true. They are. They're sort of the traditional literary foils, I suppose. Jackie is an old college friend who is an uber activist, we could say, and also sort of a foreteller of things to come. But in the present day, most of the time when we see Jackie in the book, we're seeing her via Jean's own flashbacks. So there's a sense in which Jackie Juarez, the old friend, is really, she's almost ghost-like. She's a part of Jean's conscience, right? Reminding her, okay, girl, you made your bed, now lie in it. You didn't speak up, now you don't have a voice anymore.
Do you think Jean views herself as a feminist?
Well, it's always hard to answer that question, because I think there are many different manifestations of feminism. And partly because we as women are, we're not all of the same generation, so obviously we've had different experiences. Women's rights movement in the 1970s or even in the 1960s is probably colored a little differently than the women's rights movement now. And so there's always a different perspective. But in the sense that we want to look at men and women as equal, as having the same rights, the same opportunities, the same access to either education or jobs or what have you. Absolutely, I think Jean views herself as on a par with any other man. After all, she's the top neurolinguist in her field. So sure, I think she thinks of herself as that. She just doesn't realize that she's got to do something to keep things this way.
Now, you have a background in linguistics. You earned your doctorate from Georgetown in that area. I suspect there's more than a little bit of you and Jean.
Well, I'm not a neurolinguist, and my husband's name isn't Patrick. But I think I'd be a liar to say that when I write characters, there's not some of me in all of them. That goes for even my flash fiction with jewel thieving cats or old men on front porches. I'm obviously not a cat or an old man, and I'm not a neurolinguist, but I think every writer certainly puts some of himself or herself into his character. And the fact is, I'll be really honest and above board. There have been times in my life where I have shut out politics, decided to live in a research bubble because that was what was important to me, and just not really bothered to vote. I don't do that anymore. I've changed. but perhaps there's a little bit of Jean in all of us.
The book is Vox, a novel from Christina Dalcher. And the men in this story are compelling as well. You mentioned Patrick, the husband of Jean, most interesting character. And also there is Lorenzo. Tell us about Patrick and Lorenzo.
Well, there is the men that everybody loves to hate, and in some ways. Patrick is, of course, Jean's husband. He's in a top government position. He's the science advisor to the president. And I painted him as a rather passive character, not necessarily because he's weak. I think in some ways every individual in this book is weak in some ways, because you can't help but be weak when there's a powerful state with a powerful and radical who is assuming the post of a dictator. He goes along. They need the money from his job, of course, since Jean can't work. And I think he's very much trying to cope, trying to navigate this new world and raise this family along with his wife. But at the same time, Jean has a lover, someone who is a little bit more active, someone who shares her sort of passion for linguistics and for this agenda that she's got to find cure for Wernicke's aphasia. Not necessarily political, but he's a bit of a stronger character in some ways than Patrick is, somebody who's ready to make very difficult decisions, whereas I think Patrick, for much of the book, is not willing to risk that.
Patrick is the quintessential passive man, and in today's world, people like that are not viewed favorably by most everybody. It's a terrible thing to be viewed as a wimp, isn't it?
It is, or a milquetoast. And I don't know whether I intentionally made him wimpish. I hate to say that. But there is a sense in which he doesn't want to rock the boat. So there's a difference between passivity and between, I think, just this unfortunate willingness to submit to whatever is going on around you to avoid harm. And we see this happen in a lot of dystopias, obviously, particularly given that dystopias are generally all about a totalitarian regime oppressing an individual, and the individual feels like he has very little hope. And I think that's what we see with Patrick, is this hopelessness. There's a line at the beginning of Vox that says something about everything about Patrick seems to be pointing down. It's as if he's carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. I think internally he's probably much more complex than he seems to be on the surface.
Do we view passive men more harshly than we do passive women?
That's an excellent question, Jim. Nobody's ever asked me that. You know, I wonder if we do. I was having an interesting conversation with a friend of mine the other day who mentioned something about another friend of ours who had just turned 60 and was not very happy with his life. And a friend that I was talking to said, I wonder if this situation is more difficult for men than it is for women, this idea of reaching a certain age and not viewing yourself as successful. And I think that perhaps there is some truth to that. I don't know. But if so, it's a good analogy for this this passivity. I mean, historically, women have been a little bit more quiet, a bit more submissive, a bit more willing to yield. And likewise, historically, men have not been seen that way. So perhaps that characteristic of passivity, even now, even as egalitarian as we'd like to be, mm-hmm. that characteristic, in fact, is a little bit more damnable in a man than it is in a woman. Not that I'm saying it should be, but when you look at the history of the evolution of human beings, it makes sense that we might continue to feel some strains of that.
And there is a young character in this book that is significant, Sonia, Jean's six-year-old daughter.
There are two young characters who I think are quite important to the story because they're young, but they're young in different ways. If we start with Sonia, we've got a six-year-old girl who is growing up in this new world, in this world where women, all females, are limited to 100 words a day. She doesn't know anything different. She's accepting this as her normal because it is her normal. The interesting thing about Sonia and the most frightening part about my book, Vox, actually, is the idea that Sonia may not acquire her first language as fully as a child growing up in a normal linguistic environment will. And given what we know about theories of a critical period for language acquisition, that is, you're going to use it or you're going to lose it, and you better do it by the time you're 14 or 15 years old.
Well, the Daily Beast says of Vox, a cautionary tale that is both haunting and thoroughly riveting. It is quite a ride, and it is certainly a book that has layers of complexity for women and men. And I'm told that you wrote this book in 2 months. Is that true?
Yes, it is. I'm not exaggerating. I'm a little embarrassed to say it sometimes. But the fact is, I had a hard deadline. My literary agent was going to have a baby, and she needed that manuscript lickety-split. So there's, as I've said to other people, there is no legal language in a publishing contract that can make you write faster than an agent with a baby on the way.
Congratulations, Christina Dalcher. It is quite a book. Vox, a novel that, as stated, is getting all kinds of attention and selling briskly throughout the country. It has been a pleasure. Thank you, Christina. And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on Labor Day. As always, your number is 877-217-5757. Tropical Storm Gordon has formed near the upper Florida Keys with maximum sustained winds of 45 miles per hour. Tropical storm warnings are coming for portions of South Florida and the Keys. And, of course, this will have relevance to Louisiana at some point. We will follow what's happening with Gordon. So far, it's been a mild hurricane season, and at this point, Gordon is a tropical storm, one of five tropical storms in the Atlantic Ocean in the last 30 years that has been named Gordon. Last night, LSU fared well against the Hurricanes of Miami in a game played in Arlington, Texas. The Tigers of Ed Orgeron won 33-17. Big game for former U-High star Nick Brossett, who's been largely unused in 3 years as a Tiger prior to last night, gaining just over 300 yards in his career. Last night, 22 carries, 125 yards, two touchdowns, a 50-yard gallop for Nick Brossett, who holds the Louisiana high school record with 141 touchdowns, a fabulous career, and it's good to see the young man from U-High doing so well now as a senior. It looks like he'll get lots of playing time. Tigers face southeastern Louisiana Saturday at home. SLU lost to ULM 34-31. The Lions are not a bad team, but once again, LSU will play two state teams this year in southeastern and in Louisiana Tech. But LSU will not play Southern University. Southern was also opening in the Dallas area over the weekend and lost to TCU 55-7. But why the Tigers will not play the Jaguars is a mystery, because, after all, they're right down the street. And if they're going to play Southeastern, then why doesn't LSU play Southern University? And the weekend on a national scene was highlighted by the funeral of John Sidney McCain, the U.S. Senator from Arizona who died last week, afflicted with a brain tumor for about 14 months. He was 81 years old, just short of his 82nd birthday. Presidents Obama and Bush saluted the former senator, and both of them ran races against John McCain. Barack Obama beat him to become president in 2008, and George Bush beat him to become president in the year of 2000. One president who was not in attendance was Donald John Trump, who was not invited, but his daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner did attend the service at the National Cathedral, and they had to hear words from Meghan McCain, the daughter of Senator McCain, who, it was apparent, was talking about the comparisons between her father, who was called a loser, and also was ridiculed for, quote, being captured by Donald Trump during the Vietnam War. John McCain spent 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. Donald Trump took 6 draft deferments, and we have a president now who not only did not serve in the military, but no member of his family has ever served in the military. No father, no grandfather, no son, no brother. Donald Trump has a family devoid of anyone who served in the military, and yet he is the commander-in-chief, and it was not hard to know that Meghan McCain was referring to President Trump when she made her remarks at her father's eulogy.
We gather here to mourn the passing of American greatness, the real thing, not cheap rhetoric from men who will never come near the sacrifice he gave so willingly, nor the opportunistic appropriation of those who live lives of comfort and privilege while he suffered and served. The America of John McCain is the America of the Revolution. Fighters with no stomach for the summer soldier and the sunshine patriot, making the world anew with the bells of liberty. The America of John McCain is the America of Abraham Lincoln, fulfilling the promise of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, and suffering greatly to see it through. The America of John McCain is the America of the boys who rushed the colors in every war across 3 centuries, knowing that in them is the life of the Republic, and particularly those, by their daring, as Ronald Reagan said, gave up their chance at being husbands and fathers and grandfathers, and gave up their chance to be revered old men. The America of John McCain is, yes, the America of Vietnam. Fighting the fight, even in the most forlorn cause, even in the most grim circumstances, even in the most distant and hostile corner of the world. Standing even defeat for the life and liberty of other peoples in other lands. The America of John McCain is generous and welcoming and bold. She is resourceful and confident and secure. She meets her responsibilities. She speaks quietly because she is strong. America does not boast because she has no need to. The America of John McCain has no need to be made great again, because America was always great.
All right, that's Meghan McCain with passionate remarks about her late father, the late great John Sidney McCain, who spent a lot of time campaigning in Louisiana, and he carried our state in 2008, beating President Obama by about a 60-40% margin in that year. But on the same ballot, you may remember, Mary Landrieu defeated John Kennedy to retain her U.S. Senate seat, and it was not a particularly close race. It was a 5-point victory for Senator Landrieu over then-Treasurer John Kennedy, who is a member of the U.S. Senate, a member of the Judiciary Committee, and John Kennedy will have the chance to question the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. That begins tomorrow, the hearings for Judge Kavanaugh, who is striving to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice. He's been nominated by the President of the United States, and presumably he will receive the votes of every Republican in the Senate, including Bill Cassidy and John Kennedy, and perhaps votes from a few Democrats. And a programming note that we will be preempted Wednesday as the questioning of Brett Kavanaugh takes place by the Judiciary Committee. WRKF will be carrying the live coverage from Capitol Hill from the Judiciary Committee as Justice Kavanaugh, or Judge Kavanaugh, is almost certainly to become Justice Brett Kavanaugh. We're joined in our remaining time on Labor Day in studio by Kel Waltman. She is a friend of 6 years for Sadie Thibodeau, who last month went missing, and her body was found, 32 years old, reported missing after a sailboat was found adrift in Lake Pontchartrain with no one on board, no mast, carrying only a dog and two cell phones, according to the Coast Guard. And we're going to talk about a benefit for the Cajun Navy, which rescued the body of Sadie Thibodeau. The Cajun Navy, of course, is always in action and doing good work in our community, and it's good to have you with us on Labor Day, although albeit a very sad story, Kel Waltman.
Good morning.
How well did you know Sadie Thibodeau?
I'd like to think I knew her very, very well.
Okay, we're having trouble with your microphone, so let's give it a shot here.
Good morning.
All right.
I'd like to think I knew her extremely well. We spent many, many hours together, just us hanging out, you know.
Well, when you say hanging out, what does that mean?
Well, I'm a bartender at a local bar, and she lived down the street currently from me. And so whenever it was slow, it'd be just her and I in there, and so we, you know, talked all the time.
When did you find out she was missing?
The morning of.
And it took a couple of days before you found the or heard the bad news.
Yeah, 2 days later. Went missing on the 5th and found on the 7th.
And you became a big fan of the Cajun Navy.
We've always been a big fan of the Cajun Navy, her especially.
Well, the Cajun Navy, as I stated, does fabulous work and, of course, needs sustenance to continue its mission. And that's where you come in with this benefit. When is the benefit for the Cajun Navy?
The benefit is going to be Sunday, September 9th from noon to midnight at the Vineyard on Corsi Boulevard.
That's Sunday, September 9th, as in a week from Sunday.
This coming Sunday.
A week from yesterday, the past Sunday.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So who all will be there?
We are going to have three bands for entertainment. It's going to be free food. It's open to the public, but there is a $15 cover charge at the door. But all the money from the cover charge will go to the benefit.
You said you were a fan of the Cajun Navy, Kel, before this tragedy involving Sadie. Why were you a big proponent?
Apart from Sadie's house had been flooded and Sadie's parents' house being flooded, my house also flooded. So, like, when it came back to people reaching out after the flood and them being a huge factor, it drives home.
Yeah. Well, you got to know some of these people well, I presume.
Not me personally, but she has, and people in the community, definitely.
Well, the Cajun Navy was instrumental in the rescue effort for Sadie Thibodeau, and quite often they spring into action in cases like this.
Yes.
If heaven forbid something happens with this Tropical Storm Gordon, you can bet the Cajun Navy will be there. Brian McGlynn of Baton Rouge, a retired U.S. Navy nurse who's often volunteered with the Cajun Navy, says the group had about 10 volunteers in 4 to 5 boats searching the lake.
Yes.
And the group used several drones and information on currents and wind to guide their efforts. This has become a sophisticated operation,
yes,
hasn't it?
Yes, very much so.
Well, they do exceptional jobs in times of need, and this benefit will take place 1 week from yesterday, as in this coming Sunday, September 9th, at the Vineyard
down
the street on Corsi Boulevard. And you say three bands?
Three bands, free food. We're going to have a tent.
Who are the bands?
It's Patrick Bowie and Brett Boyd, along with Bo Jameson and Damon King and Matt Cada.
All right. Well, we commend you for keeping the memory of your friend alive.
Yes.
I'm sure she'd be quite proud of you. Kel Waltman, friend of Sadie Thibodeau, who died at sea a month ago. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Engster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.